We had planned to attend Glorious Was the Cause, Churches of Christ in Early Washington Territory by Joey Rushford. You're in the right place. Dr. Rushford wrote a marvelous book that I have multiple copies of that I've given, Christians on the Oregon Trail. I used to have a subtitle to this, The World's Longest Graveyard. I don't see that on here. But it's a great book. I'll give a plug for it right now if you haven't read it. Dr. Rushford is a professor of history and Bible at Pepperdine University. This week marks his 25th year doing that. He was honored last year at Pepperdine Lectureship because for the last 20 years he has been in charge, the director of the Pepperdine Lectureship. I was kidding Jerry earlier. He's probably the only person I know that's been to more colleges than I have. So he's a very knowledgeable, educated person. His special interest is stories of church music particularly, and he'll be doing that, I think, later on this afternoon. But you're in for a treat with Dr. Jerry Rushford.
Well, good morning to you. It's an honor to be back in Tulsa. I was here 4 years ago in 1999. The class I taught 4 years ago was based on this book, Christians on the Oregon Trail, which I published in 1997. If you're interested in buying one today, the edition I see out today over here on the bookstands is the fourth edition. The first edition, a lot of people like to collect first editions. If you get on the internet, I see people selling my first edition for $75. I wouldn't give you 75 cents for that first edition. It was full of errors. I can't understand why people want first editions. I try to find my first editions and burn them. There's so many errors in it. So what you want is the fourth printing. It's the one called Revised on the cover because it's 28 pages longer. And people are always asking me, what'd you do different in the fourth printing? It's the section here in the back where I listed all the families alphabetically that came across the trail from Churches of Christ. And in that first edition and the second edition, the third edition, I had 615 families. But now in this fourth printing, I'm up to 815. We added 200 more families. So people are saying to me, where did you suddenly come up with 200 families from the Church of Christ that you didn't know about the first time you published that book? Well, we found four more charter list. Do you know what a charter list? When you find the original list of a church, the charter members. Since I published that first edition in 97, I found four additional charter lists, the most significant of which was Salem, which is the state capital. See, in those days we hadn't divided. Today we've got Christian churches and Churches of Christ. So I went back and spoke at the Christian church in Salem, First Christian Church. And I said to them, do you have any old records? And at first they said no. But then the minister thought about it and said, wait a minute. We do have a trunk that hasn't been opened in my lifetime. I doubt if it's been opened in 100 years. And he said, there's probably some stuff in there. Well, it took forever to find a key. And we got that trunk open. And sure enough, there were all those original records, who was baptized when, and it was just a gold mine, absolutely gold mine. And so that kind of thing, we found four of those. Once you get a charter list, then you can take those names and run it through the donation land claims and see how many of our brethren were out there before December 1855 and got in on the donation land claims. Then you can go and find their original farms and walk around their property and see where the well was and things like that. So that's why, if you don't have the book, you want the one that's over here at Covenant Publishing that's called Revised and Expanded, because it has 810 or 815 families listed alphabetically in this 128-page section at the back. Let me invite you to the Pepperdine Bible Lectures, and I brought the booklet. It looks like this, and they're up here on the, I brought some on the front seat up here. It's in about 5 weeks. It's absolutely free. 5,000 Christians come to it. It's a great feast. It's April 29, 30, May 1 and 2. From our advanced registration, we know that we have Christians coming from 42 states this year and 15 14 or 15 foreign countries. So it's going to be a feast. And if you can make your way to Malibu, California, April 29, 30, May 1, 2. We're already completely booked on the campus. We have 1,800 people staying in the dormitories. We have a waiting list of over 100. We will park about 200 RVs that week on the campus. Even though we don't have hookups, you can park your RV on campus. I list in the back of the booklet about 20 motels, and a lot of those are now full, but there's still some room at certain motels. So take a look at the program. Come and join us if you can. Okay, if you know anything about me, you know that I only have one gift, one gift, Christian, and my gift is telling stories. So, you know, if you were over at the Coliseum yesterday hoping that I would preach, you obviously said, well, what was that? He doesn't know how to preach. He can tell a mean story, though. But I want you to know that's what Terry told me to do yesterday. He sort of knew my strength. He said, just tell stories. That was his way of saying, that's the least you can hurt us, you know. Just get up there and tell stories. So I obeyed orders and told stories for 45 minutes. So this one today is called Glorious Was the Cause. Now, people are asking, why that title? Everybody liked this title, Christians on the Oregon Trail. That made sense. But my next book, which, by the way, will be done before August 22nd this summer, it's coming right along. I will finish it this summer. I think I'm going to call it Glorious Was the Cause, Churches of Christ and Christian Churches in Early Washington. And my reason for that is that the dominant word in all of the letters that went out to the church papers was the word cause. As a teenager, I was taught that the dominant word was the word plea. That we were interested in people hearing our plea, the restoration plea. Let's go by the Bible and be Christians only, and that's our plea. And we went all across the frontier trying to get our plea out. Can you hear me okay? I'm sort of leaning into the mic, and I can't tell if I've got good voice. But as often as we use the word plea, that wasn't the dominant word. The dominant word was cause. In every single letter, in every church paper, people would write in letters about the cause. And every letter would end up with, the cause is going good here in Illinois. Our glorious cause is advancing here in Iowa. The Redeemer's cause is going great here in Oregon. I'm writing to let you know that the cause is alive and well here in Washington. On and on. But we don't use that language anymore. I don't think anybody has a cause anymore. I'm not sure what the engine is that's driving our movement right now, but it doesn't seem to be a movement driven by a cause. All the references to cause in the 19th century, and no one ever defined it. They didn't have to. Every single person connected with this movement knew what the cause was. It was nothing less than the restoration of the primitive church. Everybody believed in the cause. They believed that God wanted them to do it. They were willing to die for it, to suffer for it, to go miles and miles to proclaim it. And they knew when they wrote back to Nashville or Indianapolis or Cincinnati or St. Louis or wherever the church papers were, if they said the cause is going well, everybody who wrote that, who read that magazine would know what that means. So I'm sort of attracted to the title, Glorious Was the Cause, sort of hinting that I have no idea how glorious that cause is now, but I'm writing about the early days. Okay, story number one. Her name was Arabella Clemens, and she was born in 1844 in Missouri. Her mother died when she was 16 years old, and her daddy said to her when she was 20, 1864, Belle, with this civil war raging all around us, you ought to get into one of these wagon trains and go west and seek your fortune in Oregon. It would break my heart to hug you goodbye, and I know I would never see you again, but I have to do what's best for you. You really ought to go. That was awfully hard for Belle to hug her daddy goodbye. She knew she would never see him again. Takes 5 or 6 months to get to Oregon, 2,000 miles. Anybody that makes it alive isn't much interested in turning around and coming back and seeing if they can get back. So she knew she would never see him again. She hugged her daddy goodbye. She was 20 years old, and she joined that wagon train. When she was an old lady in her 80s, she gave in to the requests of her grandchildren, who kept saying, "Grandma, write down your memories. All those stories you've told us all your life, write it down." And so at the age of 80, up there on Interstate 5 in Northern California, somewhere around Glenn County, surrounded by her chickens and her turkeys, sitting at her kitchen table, Belle took out a fountain pen in longhand and began to write. That was 1924. She wrote for 6 years. And in 1930, when she was 86, she took that precious manuscript, gave it to her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and said, "There, that's the best I can do." It was called The Tales of the Trail. And oh, what stories she told about coming across the trail and how many times she almost died and all the Indian battles and the buffalo stampedes and the horrible floods and almost losing her life trying to cross the North Platte River. And it's just one horrible story after another as she tries to survive the trail. But it's more than that. It's the story, really, of her whole life. And they made several copies. Everybody in the family got a copy. And, of course, the copies began to fall apart, and you'd lose a page here and there. And do you know, it took them from 1930, when she gave that to them, it took her family 35 years. It was a whole generation later, in 1965, that some of the members of her family said, "We better publish this. We're going to lose this story." And they all chipped in their money, and they published 500 copies. That's what you call a rare book. 500, not 5,000. 500 in 1965, and it's never been reprinted. It's a black hardback, over 400 pages, The Tales of the Trail. Well, when the word got out in the state of Washington that I was writing a history of the early church Christ, two brothers who are leaders in the church in Pateros, Washington, decided, they each had a copy of their grandmother's book, and they decided that they would give up one copy and give it to Jerry. And so I got this in the mail. "Dear Jerry, we have decided to give as a gift a rare copy of our grandmother's autobiography, Tales of the Trail. And if you're interested in the church in Washington, you would want to read this book." Well, I confess that I didn't get around to reading it right away. I was busy. But when I finally picked it up and started reading it, I was absolutely transfixed. I couldn't believe a woman with no training, no education, could write like this. Her sentence structure, her syntax, her use of adjectives, her use of imagery, her vision in writing. It was just her vocabulary. I mean, it was an amazing achievement for a woman between 80 and 86. I mean, my mom is 84. I don't think my mom could write what this woman wrote. Between 80 and 86, to write that book, Tales of the Trail. And I'm very proud to have one of the 500 copies. I saw one in a used bookstore in Idaho one time, and it was for sale for $85, and it was behind glass. I asked them to bring it out. You know, it was in a locked case. And they said, "Is that too much?" And I said, "No, that's a very fair price. There's only 500 of them, and $85 is probably a fair price." So she wrote that between 80 and 86, and it's all about coming across the trail. And here's what she says. "I made it as far as a little settlement on the Boise River in Idaho Territory, a little settlement called Boise. It was September 25, 1864, and I said to everybody in the wagon train, 'I think I'm just going to stop here.' And they said, 'Oh, no, Belle, come on, we're going to Oregon, seek our fortune. We're going all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Don't leave now.' And she said, 'No, this looks pretty good, and I'm tired of traveling.' And there was a place that called itself a hotel. And she asked them if she could have a job, and they gave her a job. And she waved goodbye to that wagon train, September 25, 1864. And within 2 days, she had met Frank Fulton, who she was going to marry. Courtship was fast on the American frontier. There weren't many women, single women, hanging around Boise, Idaho in 1864, and Bell was 20 years old, and Frank was 33. He stopped in at that hotel and saw her. He married her on November 24, less than 2 months. And they had 10 children, and this is amazing to me. All 10 of their children grew to maturity. Now, that's rare in the 19th century. Infant mortality was very high, and you always buried half your children. And all 10 of them lived to maturity. And all 10 became great leaders in the Church of Christ. Their oldest boy, Lee, became one of the best-known preachers in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, California. Their youngest daughter, Jackie, who married David Nichols. David was one of our great preachers in the Northwest. David had gone to school under David Lipscomb and James Harding at the old Nashville Bible School, and he came out west. And it was their children, the Nichols, who sent me that book. They're the leaders of the Church of Christ today in Pateros, Washington. Well, here's what happened. She met Frank, and they got married, and he said, I got a little place out here west of town. They went out west of town. He had a log cabin out there, and they built a schoolhouse out there. There wasn't a name to that community. There is today. It's called Star. Any of you ever been in Star, Idaho? The old Christian church in Star, Idaho. Victor, you ever been there? It's got a sign right out there in front of the church that says, this congregation established in January 1870. Oldest Christian church in Idaho Territory. That's absolutely correct. They moved out there when they married in 1864, and she said to Frank, I wish we could have a church. We had churches back in Missouri. I don't know what kind they were, but we went to church. He said, well, we're not going to have any church out here. There wouldn't be any preacher ever come to this valley. And he was right. There wasn't any preacher for quite a while. But she always kept harping at it. I wish we had a church. She gave birth to baby one. That was Lee. Then she gave birth to baby two. And she kept saying, I wish we had a church. And then she said, we don't even have a Bible. I wish we had a Bible. She found out that one of her neighbors had a Bible, and she borrowed that Bible, 1867. Started reading that Bible. She read it all through 67 and 68. Got into 1869. She was pregnant with baby three. She kept saying to Frank, I wish we had a church. He kept saying, we don't even have a preacher. No preacher had ever come into this valley. And then one day, here he came. In late November of 1869, he was 52 years old. His name was Michael Boley, B-O-L-I, or B-O-L-Y. I've seen it spelled both ways. She writes in her book, he was a follower of some man named Alexander Campbell, who was a well-known reformer, she said, of that day. He said to us that he wasn't sent by any missionary society or any church or anybody. He had just gotten on his horse, and he was out preaching the good news of Jesus Christ. Come to find out, he had ridden his horse all the way from Walla Walla, Washington. And he had been preaching in the Piette Valley. He was filthy dirty. His long beard was filthy. His clothes were filthy. He wasn't much to look at. But he came riding in there, end of November of 1869. Some people came out to the road, and he said, would you all like some preaching? They said, well, you probably got to go over there and to the Fulton's house. Told him how to get to the Fulton's. He rode up there, got out. Frank came out. And this rather unimpressive guy said, would you like some preaching? Frank took a look back over his shoulder. And he thought, oh boy, I'd like to send this guy on his way. But if Bell ever heard that I'd sent this guy away, she hit me with a frying pan. He said, yeah, I guess that'd be all right. You can preach Sunday morning. It was a Friday that he rode in. You can preach Sunday morning at 11 o'clock down here at our schoolhouse. He called over two of his boys, farmhands. He said, boys, get on your horses and start riding. Ride through the whole settlement tell everybody for miles around there's preaching this Sunday at 11 o'clock at the Fulton Schoolhouse. And off they went, riding. Sunday morning came, and my goodness, here they came in buckboards and wagons and on foot and on horseback. The whole settlement, they hadn't had preaching. The word spread like wildfire. There's going to be preaching Sunday morning at the Fulton School. Can you even imagine that world? That's a world so foreign to us. Here's how Bell describes it. She writes so much better than I can tell it. I'm going to let her tell the story. Listen to how this woman gives imagery. He arrived on horseback with a pair of saddlebags slung across the saddle. In them he carried a Bible and a dozen or so hymn books and a change of linen. Boy, I tell you, you get on a horse with a Bible, a dozen or so hymn books, and a change of linen, you can do a lot of good in this world. You can make a difference. He pulled up there in Star, Idaho, with his Bible and a dozen hymn books and a change of linen. The latter, the change of linen, was in need of washing, for he had been on the road a long time, having stopped and preached in the Piatt Valley. But it was not linen, as I learned when I washed it. It was mostly woolen, such as everybody usually wore for underwear. His wearing apparel was not of very good quality, and it was much worn, and he had long, unkempt hair and beard. But in those days, oh, by the way, I won't give his name, but I was reading this to the official writer at Pepperdine University, who writes all the speeches for our president and so on. And he said, she misspelled unkempt. I said, no, I don't think so. U-N-K-E-M-P-T, unkempt? No, that's correct. He had never heard the word. He said, she meant unkept. I said, no, I don't think so. I think she meant unkempt. We looked it up, and it's there in the dictionary. This woman knows what she meant. She said his hair was unkempt. I saw it. I was there, put my hands in it. It was a mess. It was unkempt. So she's sharper than some of the people working at Pepperdine University in 2003. This woman who never went to school a day of her life, probably. She says, in those days, we never judged a man by his outward appearance. He told my husband his business. Frank said he could preach down at the schoolhouse, and on and on. That was on Friday. Well, on Sunday morning, here they all came. Almost everyone in the settlement gathered at the schoolhouse. They came in lumber wagons and on horseback and on foot. But when he got up to preach, everybody, she said, was pretty disappointed. He looked so backwoodsy. He was so unclean, and he just looked pretty disappointing. Until, she says, he opened his mouth, and she acknowledged the man could preach. She said he opened his mouth, and he spoke with vigor. He was a vigorous speaker, and he presented his doctrine with a firmness of conviction, and he aroused the interest of the congregation. That was Sunday morning. Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night, he continued to preach, and the people continued to flock. Now, who do you think is going to be the first person in all of Idaho territory to obey the gospel? You're way ahead of me on this one. Bell is in her 80s when she's remembering this story, and she writes, after hearing a few of his sermons, I decided to become a Christian. So when the invitation was given, I went forward and gave the preacher my hand in token of my willingness to be baptized. What month did I tell you it was? November. Late November, 1869, and the Boise River, which is not very big to start with, had frozen over. Now here's a little quiz for you. Who do you think got the job of going down to the Boise River with his axe to cut a hole in that thing? Yeah, good old Frank. I'd love to have an audio recording of that conversation. Frank and two or three of the boys are headed down there to the river, and Frank is saying something like this. Now, boys, Belle's a good woman. She's a good woman. She's borne me 2 children. We got a 3rd one on the way. She's a good woman, she is, that Belle. But I'll tell you, this is ridiculous. Go down here and cut a hole in the ice. She's going to catch her death of cold. I've never heard anything so. And you know, he's absolutely right. It is ridiculous to the world, to the unbeliever, to those outside of Christ, cutting holes in frozen rivers. This is ridiculous. But she said to him, Frank, you get on down there and cut that hole. And you cut it big enough for me to get down there, you hear? And he mumbles his way down there. And this is what she writes. She says, the day for the baptizing was in late November, and the weather was pretty cold. The little stream was covered with ice, which had to be broken. I went down into the cold water, and I was buried with my Savior in the watery grave, arising with Him to a newness of life, with a consciousness that my past sins were all forgiven, and with a hope of life eternal, which is promised to all who remain faithful in Christ Jesus. I don't think you can write it any better than that. And then she says, new paragraph, I have always considered this the most important event in my life. Wow. More important than your marriage to Frank, yeah. More important than the day you gave birth to your firstborn, yeah. More important than when you gave birth to all 10 of your, yeah. The most important day of my life. Why, Belle? Why was that the most important day? She says, because it helped to shape my own life and the lives of my family on a higher and nobler plane, and giving me principles, thereby laying the foundation for a happy and useful life. A few years later, my husband was baptized into Christ, came into the church, and all of our children, all 10, as they grew older, we saw them too, one by one, gathered into the fold. We found the influence of the church to be of a great help to us in rearing our children. It helped them overcome unworthy impulses and desires. It helped them build up strong citizens and become useful citizens and build their character. She says, several were baptized there in late November. And Boli said, I'll be back around Christmas time. And he rode on home. And true to his word, he came back about Christmas time. He crossed the mountains and he preached, baptized a bunch more. And they established a congregation in January 1870, and the sign is still there in Star, Idaho. First congregation from the Restoration Movement in all of Idaho territory. And Belle says modestly, I'm pretty certain that I was the first person ever baptized into Christ in Idaho. Well, that's a great story. And she has many more about her life in the church. She's buried in the cemetery beside Frank at Ellensburg, Washington. And her children spread out and had a tremendous impact on the church. But she said, the greatest moment of my life is when Boli and I went down underneath that icy water, when he laid me under that water and I met Christ down there. And I died with him. And I was washed in the blood of the Lamb. I washed my robes in the blood of the Lamb. I went down into the icy water and met Christ. And I came up from that death to a new life. And a few years later, I led my husband to Christ, my children to Christ. Now, that's history, and that bores a lot of people, and that animates me so much that I can't hardly take it. I love the stories of history. Now, I'm about to shift over to put the rest of this on the screen, and they tell me that you're going to have a tough time hearing me, because when I move the microphone, it gets in front of this, and they're going to try to just keep that microphone on. And so I'm going to make an announcement right now that I'm going to do something different at 4 o'clock. Everywhere I go, I get asked to do 2 things. Restoration history, which is what I've done here, or the history of hymns. I actually get invited to do hymns more than church history. So this afternoon at 4, I'm going to switch my title because I wanted to stay right here and not worry with overhead. So you can pass the word. At 4 o'clock, I want to tell you about Amazing Grace, how that came to be written, where that music came from, and I'm going to tell you more stories in 45 minutes than you wanted to know, but I doubt that you've heard these stories about the hymns were written. So if you love the old hymns, we'll just tell stories from 4 to 4:45, but I'm going to open with Amazing Grace. That's what we'll do, and we'll avoid using the screen. But right now I'm going to put some things on the screen. The first is to give you an idea of the word cause. I'll just give you one quote. This is from our brother Alexander Vance McCarty, preaching out here in Oregon. Here's a typical letter back home. He's writing back to Indiana, and he says, "I would just observe that the glorious cause of truth is gaining ground in this far-off country very fast. Religious society here has felt the chilling influence of the gold-hunting mania." See, he writes this in 1852. "Still, I have the pleasure to inform you that our cause," and I put this in alpha, in capital letters. He didn't do this. I want you to see the word cause. "Our cause is progressing. Fresh auxiliaries are brought into requisition. The tide of interest seems high in many bosoms, gathering new strength as it sweeps heavenward. Many are enlisting in the good cause with strong emotions of love and hearts beating high for the glory set before them in the gospel of Christ. I hope that the cause may continue to spread its heavenly influence on these Pacific shores until every obstacle has been removed and the cross of Christ be venerated and loved by all. We have many good brethren here who love the cause of Christ, who love the cause, and who are devoted to its advancement. They regard Christianity not as a cold formula or a heartless ceremony, but as a living, life-conducting principle reared up in the temple of the heart. Numbers have been immersed here within the last few months. We have an evangelist in the field who is doing good service. May the Lord prosper him." Written on November 9th, 1852, from out here in the West. That's how they looked at the cause. Now, if I had time, and I don't, I'll just show you this page. I would lecture on the seven restoration movements that shaped us out here in the West. And we would talk about the restoration movement in Great Britain, which is my favorite. I go to England every year. I've been there every year since 1971. I lead tours there every May. I think I've done as much research on the history of the Restoration Movement in the British Isles as anyone. And if you had a week, we could have a good time here for a week just talking about England and Scotland and Ireland. Number two is the Restoration Movement in Canada. I went to school in Canada. I lived at Great Lakes Christian College. I've done a lot of research on Canada. Number three is Australia. I've never been there. I don't know a lot about the movement there, but I've read books. Number four, five, six, and seven are the movements in our own country. James O'Kelly and Rice Hager that came out of the Methodist Church. Elias Smith and Abner Jones that came out of the Baptist Church. Barton Stone, who was Presbyterian, and John Mulkey, who was Baptist, who came out of their respective movements in 1804 and 1809, and then they merged their movements in 1811. And finally, the Campbells, father and son, whose movement begins in 1809. All of those threads end up in Washington, Oregon, out in the West. And if we had time, I would sort of put that together into a fabric. Let me suggest that our history in Washington looks something like this, that the first members of the church come out in 1847. Probably the first member of the Church of Christ in Washington Territory is probably Isaac Flint, one of our preachers, who got in a canoe and went all over Puget Sound trying to see where he was going to live and capsized his canoe and almost drowned, and the Indians had to save him. And others came in 49, 50, 51. But the first year that we had a lot of people come was 52. From 52 to 1880 was what I call wondrous beginnings. 80 is a real watershed time, because that's the year that one of our preachers was elected President of the United States. When that happens, that affects any movement. And I wrote a 400-page PhD dissertation at the University of California on the impact of James Garfield. I love that story. Garfield's the only preacher in the history of our nation to become President of the United States, and he was one of our preachers. And that's right at the time that we were about to divide between disciples of Christ and churches of Christ. And Garfield was very much disciples of Christ. He was very progressive, very theologically liberal, and the majority of the movement was in agreement with him. And you can see the tensions begin to take place like in a place like Washington. From 1880 to 1890, we witnessed the tragedy of division. By 1890, everybody in Washington, Oregon, pretty much knows what side they're on. And then it's going to be time for the conservatives, the Churches of Christ, to rebuild. The rebuilding process is going pretty strong by 1900. One of our great preachers, S.O. Poole, Samuel Orange Poole, moves to Washington in 1902, and he gets on his horse and circles the whole state, and he writes back to the church papers in Indiana and Tennessee and Illinois, and he says, "We have about 19 congregations that have not bowed the knee to Baal, you know, that are still faithful, that have not been a part of the disciples of Christ, that have, you know, after this division." And so that gives you an idea of about the size of the movement at that time. Here's a map of Washington, and give you a feel of the growth of the church in Washington looked something like this. All of the first people who came lived along here, what I call the I-5 corridor between Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington. I don't believe I-5 was there yet. I'm not sure, but they've settled right in there along the I-5 corridor. The second area that our people grew in was right down here in Klickitat County. And the third area, which became the greatest area of all, was way out here in the west in Whitman County. We had 25 congregations of the Church of Christ in Whitman County. Why? Because all of our people were farmers. And Whitman County is as flat as it can be. It looks like Kansas. It's all wheat country. And all the members of the church who moved west settled in Spokane County and Whitman County because they were farmers. We were not mountain people. I don't know of any Churches of Christ in the mountains of Washington in these early years. Our people didn't settle in the mountains. They settled in the valleys, along the rivers, and in the plains. Now, the difficulty with our history with Churches of Christ is how divisive we have been. Not just with the disciples of Christ, with each other. So the Churches of Christ in the late 1880s in Washington, which were going through division, what they needed from Tennessee and Indiana and Illinois and Texas was unity and strength. And it wasn't there. Here was the situation from our four leading papers in the 1880s. In the North, we had two papers. The Christian Leader, edited by John F. Rowe, started in 1886. And the American Christian Review, taken over by Daniel Sommer in 1886. And Sommer and Rowe did not like each other, so there was no fellowship between the two Church of Christ papers in the North. Isn't that just great? So how are we going to win many people to Christ in that situation? In the South, it was no better. The two dominant papers were the Gospel Advocate in Nashville, started over in 1866 by David Lipscomb, and the Firm Foundation in Austin, Texas, started by Austin McGarry in 1884, and the two of them didn't like each other. So there was no fellowship between the Firm Foundation and the Gospel Advocate. Which was the most conservative and which was the most progressive? Well, in the South, the more open, progressive paper was the Gospel Advocate, and the more conservative was the Firm Foundation. In the North, the more open, progressive paper was the Christian Leader, and the more conservative was the Review. So, ironically, the Review with Daniel Sommer got along great with the Firm Foundation and Austin McGarry. They sent articles to each other all the time. And the Gospel Advocate got along great with the Christian Leader, and they exchanged articles all the time, but the four papers didn't. That's where we were in the late 1880s. Now, the Churches of Christ and the disciples divided. The famous date is 1906 when the United States government recognized it, but we were clearly divided by 1890. I'm taking my book up to 1916. Why? Seems like an arbitrary date. When I tell people I'm writing the history of the church in Washington from 1850 to 1916. I mean, doesn't that sound like a dumb date? That sounds like a dumb date to me. 1916, there's nothing round about it. Why would I pick that date? Because the United States government conducted religious censuses every 10 years, starting in 1906. The census in 1906 was not accurate, for a very obvious reason. The Churches of Christ didn't cooperate. David Lipscomb wasn't interested in counting heads, and so if he's not going to cooperate, we're not going to be treated very well in that census. So you go back and look at 1906, for historians like me, we don't even use it anymore. It's not helpful. It's not accurate. But 1916 was possibly the finest religious census ever put out in America. 1926 was also pretty good, and 1936 was bad again, full of errors. So bad that they decided not to do it anymore. So there was only those four. And the only two that are helpful are 1916 and 26. We haven't had good statistics until recently through, in fact, Victor Knoll's teaching a class on that for me in 5 weeks at Pepperdine. Victor, one of your titles is about why the fastest growing and so on. These statistics are from Mary something, what's it called? The Glen Mary, yeah. The Glen Mary Association, which is, I think, a Roman Catholic organization, they're putting out the finest censuses that we've got. And so we have good numbers right now. And, of course, Mack Lynn is putting out his directory. And so we have a pretty good idea of how big we are now. But let me go back and show you 1916 after we divided with the disciples. We'll start with Washington. The disciples ended up with 124 churches in 1916. Churches of Christ had 34. Members? How do we count members? Baptized believers. We don't count our children. Oh, our class is up. I'll just look at these statistics, and I'll see you here at 4 o'clock, and we'll do hymns. Churches, members, male-female breakdown, and church buildings. How many buildings did we owe? And then you see the Oregon and California, about the same in each state. In Oregon, the disciples had 122 churches. We had 23. The disciples had 165 churches in California, and we had 35. Churches of Christ only had 17 church buildings in California in 1916, the oldest being Forestville, which is still standing. We only had 18 up in Oregon, the oldest being Molalla, and part of that is still standing. And the oldest up in Washington, we only had 20. And I'm writing an article this week on the Old Church of Christ in Porter, Washington, which was built in 1907, but we don't have a congregation there anymore. The building is still there. The old church in Dixie is still there, which was built in the 1880s. I'll leave this up here for a moment. You can study it. But I know you want to get over at 11 o'clock. Mark Frost is preaching. Thank you for coming. I'll be back at 4 o'clock and we'll just tell stories.